Welcome, Mush Fam, to another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast. This is a podcast dedicated to bridging the gap between you, our lovely, amazing, beautiful listeners, and the wacky world of fungi. So today, we are bringing on an amazing guest and a longtime dear friend, Lexi Gropper.
Welcome, Lexi Gropper. Lexi is a biologist dedicated to deepening her understanding of the life cycles with a passion for the processes of decomposition leading to regrowth. She dedicates her energy to the cultivation of plants, fungi, bacteria, relationships, community, and healing. Lexi has been living in the Ecuadorian Amazon for the past 6 years. She lives on her family's reforested jungle and food forest island in the middle of a sea of deforestation and ongoing contamination from petroleum extraction, cattle ranching, and cash crop monocultures. The name of their project is Amisacho Restoration, where they've dedicated themselves to three direct lines of action in their region, including restoring ecosystems, restoring health, and restoring community. And this is such a big, beautiful project that you have going on. And I remember meeting you at New Moon and just hearing about your work more in detail, like completely fell in love with your work and your mission, and we're super excited to have you on, finally talk about it.
Hey everybody, thanks so much for reaching out. It really means a lot, especially to be able to share our story and to connect during these challenging times. So thanks a lot, happy to be here.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us how you got into the world of fungi?
Back in university, I had a really neat opportunity to do a personal internship. There was a one mycologist on campus at Appalachian State, and at that time I was studying biology. I thought I wanted to go into the medical field, and I was really interested in medicinal fungi, and the research that was being done at Bastyr for using different mycomedicinals for cancer treatments. And I ended up taking a semester off school and not pursuing my passion for Bastyr, but I actually got a job at Ecovative up in Troy, New York, growing mushroom packaging to replace styrofoam. And that was where I learned my first sterile cultivation techniques and got a passion and interest more into the world of applied mycology. And that really opened up my eyes into so many different possibilities of how fungi can enter into our daily world and lifestyles. And then there was a really neat opportunity with the Amazon Micro-Renewal Project where I went out to a course in California, and I just really fell in love with the idea of micro-remediation. I mean, that was a really fantastic course with Lila Darwish, Peter McCoy, Maya Ellison, Mia Maltz, Willoughby Arevalo, and Bob Rawson. And so it was just really easy to get how not to get fascinated. And So, you know, and I guess as anybody in the mycology field knows, once you enter into that, the portal or enter into the field, it's just more and more expands, and it just spikes your interest. Yeah.
That's awesome. And yeah, the second I found out about that course and Amazon Micro-Renewal Project, and the first time we jumped on a Skype call, I really connected with you and your work, and you're an awesome human and really respect what you're doing. So shout outs to you, and I'm happy to have you on the show. But more on a serious note, can you talk about Texaco, now Chevron, and kind of a little background of the area that you are in the Sucumbíos region, and kind of the history of petroleum extraction in that area?
So within in the early 60s, Texaco, what's formerly known as Chevron, opened up pristine jungles in the northeastern Amazon. And the first city that they made home base to is Lago Agrio, which our land is based out of. Lago Agrio and the old oil fields of Texaco. We actually live at oil drill number 26, which was put in by Texaco. And during those 30 years, they practiced really, really, really nasty methods and poor methods of petroleum extraction. And where 10 years prior to them coming to Ecuador, they had discovered the technology to reinject formation water back into the core of the earth and back underground. So the formation water is all the saline liquids and corrosive liquids and chemicals that they use to help in drilling, and it helps helps the drills go down deeper. It breaks open rocks, and it also cleans out the well to get all the last gunk and crude petroleum out. So they had discovered that technology to reinject, right? But while they were here in Ecuador, since they were really opening the frontier in extracting natural resources, environmental laws didn't exist at the time. And so it was cheaper for them to dig these Olympic-sized pits, unlined pits, and filled it up with all of their wasted formation water, which also had crude petroleum still stuck into it, instead of reinjecting it back into the soil. So they saved a lot of money, millions of dollars, by doing that. But as a result, throughout the Sucumbíos region and the Orellana region, there's over 1,000 Olympic-sized pits full of this crude petroleum and formation water. And it's just perfectly designed where every one of those pits has a tube called a gooseneck pipe. And they're perfectly designed to overflow into a nearby stream. So every time it rains, which is a lot in the rainforest, those pits overflow and they go straight into the nearby streams, which, you know, the streams are all headwaters to somebody. And so the rivers in Ecuador flow into Peru and Brazil and all the indigenous communities and colonial communities that also depend on those rivers. So in the 90s, Texaco was kicked out, and the Union of Affected People Against Texaco, UDAPT, they represent around 30,000 people in a legal lawsuit against Texaco, which has been going on for over 27 years. And Texaco, now Chevron, has found all of the loopholes in international law as a corporation to not hold responsibility and to even turn the lawsuit against the natives and the local communities here, calling them mafia and fraudulent, having, you know, turning the case against them, saying that they're making it all up. And so it's just really, really nasty history, dark, that had a really, really complex chain of events and history of trauma on the communities and on the indigenous communities, especially, and the colonial communities. It's a tough situation. So, and then we have the current companies, the state-owned companies that took over after Chevron. But, you know, since this region was already so sacrificed, it just continues to be sort of a sacrifice zone. And just a couple days ago, there a huge pipeline that transports all of the petroleum from the Amazon across the country to the coast, and then exports to the U.S. That pipeline the land underneath the pipeline was eroding, and it fell into a big river, which leads into two headwater rivers that so many communities, especially during quarantine, are dependent on that river for drinking water or for hunting and fishing. And it's just, there's just a lack of respect towards the environment and it's the inhabitants here, and more only an interest in profit.
Mm-hmm. So can you help us like picture what this actually looks like? I mean, you said you lived at like oil drill number 26, right? So when you walk out your door, like what parts of that drill do you see, and how does this affect your personal day-to-day life?
Yeah, right outside the door, like in the middle of the cul-de-sac, it's a dirt road. And in the middle of the cul-de-sac, it's an abandoned pipeline. So it's closed down now since Chevron's no longer practicing. And this particular pipeline has been closed down. And so it's just, it looks like an old statue. It's like a monument. And it's turned into the cul-de-sac soccer field. So the out of bounds is the oil drill. But pretty much every neighborhood has its own drill. Some are still active, depending on the companies. And the stream that runs through our property is extremely contaminated because we're about 2 miles or 2 kilometers from the state oil company Petro Amazonas, and so this stream passes through all of their mechanical workshops, and so it's just used as their trash can. It's the easiest way to get rid of their waste if you can't see it, right? So, mm-hmm. And that's a common reality for a lot of people. On top of those oil pits, there's over 446 continuous gas flares, which are, they're horrendous. And not only is it just awful air and dioxins that it's just polluting straight into the air and rains as acid rain and heavy metals, but it's also these giant burning flares in the middle of the Amazon. So you're talking about the most biodiverse region in the world per hectare, per unit. And so if you understand how an ecosystem works and how the food chain in an ecosystem works, like the food pyramid, right? 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, those gas flares are burning. So what do insects do at night when there's a light? They're attracted to it, right? And so if you go to these gas flares, there's just a cemetery of charred insects at the base, and it's unbelievable, something you can't imagine. I started collecting these insects because they're just, I mean, there's endangered species, exotic species, and a diversity of the most beautiful insects that you know are the bottom of the food chain of the Amazon. And it's just, it's so wrong in so many ways.
Yeah, I actually went on a trip to Ecuador in, I think it was 2015, I want to say. So 5 years ago now. And we were traveling around studying different ecosystems and biodiversity and the anthropogenic effects on them. And and the leader, you know, he was studying biodiversity of insects, specifically butterflies in the Amazon. And, you know, he was like, you know, the best spot to look for butterflies and like new species is actually, you know, these, the burning sites that you were just talking about. And he said, you can find new species all the time. And it's like, it's bittersweet because as a scientist, you know, you get all overjoyed that you found a new species or like, you know, and sometimes it helps to protect them and to document them and X, Y, Z. And then you look up and there's this graveyard and burning just huge flame. So it's this weird situation. And he's like, you know, it sucks because that's the best place to go to find new insect species. But like, it's a weird place to find them, to put it lightly. And I got to see a pit in person by accident. I stumbled upon it. I think I was in Sumaco Napo Galeras National Park or Parque Nacional Yasuni. And it was weird. We had to it was an oil rig, and we had to be let in by the oil company, and all of our stuff had to be put through an X-ray, and we went through a metal detector, weren't allowed to bring in any alcohol or anything, and we were kind of kept watch over. We were doing some research, and they were like watching our every moves. They had guns. It was weird. It was a weird situation. And I went on a walk one day and saw some, like, you know, some break in the road and some caution tape. And I just looked. It was probably like 600 meters in the distance was an oil pit and some, like, you know, caution tape around it. Very weird. And such a crazy juxtaposition with, it's literally in Ecuador, the most biodiverse place on the planet. And then to have this destruction happening right on top of it is the weirdest feeling you'll ever feel. It's like the most different energies that you'll ever come across, right next to each other or right on top of each other. And that leads to, you know, the next topic, which is the Amazon Micro-Renewal Project, now called Co-Renewal, and how I found out about you. Can you talk about that project and what y'all were doing and if it's still going on and what's happening right now?
Yeah. So about 6 years ago, I had the opportunity. I got a funding opportunity with my university to come down, and there was a group of us who came down the first time. Well, not the first time, because Amazon Micro-Renewal Project had a history of working with volunteers down here, but there had been a couple year gap in that course in 2013, kind of revamped it. And so we had a new flush of volunteers that came down, and I came in that group and just really fell in love with the landscapes and the diversity of culture, the diversity, biodiversity, diversity of lands and mountains and jungle and coast. And I fell in love with the social justice initiatives, and also fell in love with a human. And during that time we had that we worked with volunteers, it was really something special. It was really amazing. There was people sharing these same hopes of wanting to do something and wanting to contribute their time from all over the world. It was really neat, just a strong intercultural exchange and time being spent together and learning together and learning, exchanging skills. Although, you know, for me, I had ended up staying down here, and I kind of found myself shifting into this position of like organizing the people who came down here and their trips and making sure they were safe and their food and what we were going to do. And I think I really lost track of my passion and what I came here to do. And it was difficult because a lot of people didn't speak Spanish. And they, when they came, they were quick to leave. And that's difficult to be able to integrate into the local communities, right? And so we just ended up recognizing that that wasn't a sustainable practice. It wasn't going to continue. And experiments and projects, and, you know, they're long-term observation and implementation and community trust and collaboration. And that was difficult for with temporary people coming in and out. So So we ended up, decomposing the Amazon Micro-Renewal Project. And my husband and I built our own house and laboratory on my in-laws' property, where they 12 years ago they started a reforestation project in the middle of this sea of deforestation from the extraction and the encroaching cities and the monocultures. So we've been doing our own research and gaining our own personal experience and practice here. And a lot of people have reached out with specific skill sets that have been interested in coming down to teach and share with our communities here. And other people, we've been fortunate to have the opportunity to be able to invite them to come down here and work with us to help develop the projects a little bit more and collaborate with local organizations. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And can you talk about the research that you guys can and are doing in your lab?
Well, we're the only mushroom cultivators at this altitude of the Amazon that I know of. I'd love to hear if there's more. We're 300 meters at this level of the Amazon. And so all the other mushroom cultivators that I know of are at the level of the cloud forest and higher. So it's a much fresher, colder environment. And whereas here we have a lot of challenges as far as mushroom cultivation goes. So for a while, when I was interested and particularly stoked on mycoremediation, it was of interest to try and cultivate species in the laboratory and explore training them, quote unquote, or exposing them to different petroleum concentrations and seeing if they would take off and what species. But that was really difficult. It was really difficult because mold grows on everything here. Mold grows on my scale. It grows on the table that I'm cultivating on. It grows on the filter. And then it's like once you actually take that organism out into the real world, it's immediately dominated by the ecosystem. And so my whole approach towards soil regeneration and remediation in general has completely changed. And that's not how, like, those approaches for me wasn't observing nature, that wasn't imitating nature. And so our laboratory really now has been just trying to figure out low-tech and replicable mushroom cultivation techniques that people can, you know, given the reality of our climate and economic realities here, providing practices and techniques that people can replicate and what types of agricultural resources. So the laboratory right now is more focused on edible and medicinal fungi production, as well as essential oil extraction and other self-care products and researches. Whereas we're taking our interest in ecosystem restoration outside of the laboratory and into our own and into the soil, because that's where the real beauty and observation takes place. Mm-hmm. So when you go to these sites, right, like you went to, Alex, those pits, at least here in Sucumbíos and Orellana, these pits are over 50 years old. So it's really fascinating because when you look at them, they're actually like quite alive. There's a lot of plants and diversity and fungi growing directly out of saturated logs. So whether the plants and the fungi and the bacteria are growing on the organic matter that's falling on top of the crude pit and building up, and they're just living on that, or whether they're actually, their enzymes and their metabolic digestion is breaking down or feeding off of the petroleum hydrocarbons, you know, that's a really interesting area of research if one has the funding to do laboratory testing. We've been really interested in trying to figure out what species are growing around there and trying to observe what plants are growing around there and trying to explore with different methods of expansion that don't require a laboratory.
Yeah, and so much respect for you because that it's hard. It's hard growing mushrooms in that environment. I went down to Jamaica a couple years ago and came in with this like this mentality of like, oh yeah, this is the way to grow mushrooms, you know? And they're like, you know, they're like, yeah, I mean, we tried shiitake logs and someone came down here a couple years ago and planted some shiitake logs for us and the termites ate them in a month.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? What do you, like, things that I didn't even realize were an issue. And, you know, I went to Otavalo, which you were talking about, like, cloud forest. It's a little easier to grow mushrooms. And they had a whole, like, kind of mushroom log garden. And they looked like they were 10, 15 years old. The logs were all rotten. I'm like, oh, yeah, these look like they're, like, 10 years old or something. And they're like, no, we planted those, like, last year. Mm-hmm. Like, things are just, you know, at a different pace. And then, you know, the bugs that you have to deal with and the mold and like gnarly mold too. I'm sure you deal with black mold and everything. So props to you to figure out techniques that people can use. And you work with a women-led co-op. Is that right?
We had prior we've done training. We had an exciting space to do training with them where there was this women's co-op, but again, that was in higher altitude. It was near the volcano El Reventador. And we were just driving one day and saw this sign that said, se vende hongos, mushrooms for sale. And I was like, whoa, what? Like, I hadn't heard of anybody, at least in this side of Ecuador, that had cultivated mushrooms. And so we stopped and we went in and these women were telling us, they were just showing us all of their contamination. And they just couldn't, and they were closing the co-op because, I mean, they were closing the cultivation side of the mushroom production side of things because they just were wasting so much time and their own resources and nobody was helping them. And so I was asking them, like, well, where did you learn how to cultivate? And they said that, and where do you buy your spawn? Because they weren't producing it. And so back in the day, there's a lot more cultivators now in these days, and particularly in the Andes Mountains and higher elevations. But back in the day, there was pretty much one kind of like monopoly, one farm mushroom producer that sold spawn to everybody, but didn't teach anybody how to make their own spawn or didn't really teach anybody enough about cultivation for them to be independent. And so these women, they didn't know really about fungi and who they are and how they work and their cycle and why they need humidity and why they need fresh air exchange and why they need a diversity of foods, etc. And so they didn't have that knowledge to adapt or explore when they had contamination, to think about trying other methods. If you understand how something lives and works, then you can experiment around those factors, right? Mm-hmm. So we had a really, really nice space, nice workshops there for a time, teaching them that. And it was neat to see their gardens grow and their produce grow from their mushroom spawn bags too. That was neat. Mm-hmm. And so now we started what's called the Hope Fair. It's kind of a traveling Hope Fair. It's the only I guess, fair or market once a month that brings permaculture or organic farmers from the province and or from all from Sucumbíos and Oriana. It's the only place where you can find products that with confidence that haven't been fumigated with pesticides. And it's cool because they come all the way from Reventador and they come and they'll sell their mushrooms and their the produce, their veggie produce at the fair. We also had another group, another women's co-op, around 70 Afro-Ecuadorian women drove 8 hours to come to Amisachu to learn about processing of aromatic plants and making essential oils to elaborate a line of self-care products. And yeah, it's just, it's that feeling when your work feeds your soul. You know, that was one of the most exciting courses that we've gotten to do.
Totally. That's some important empowerment that you guys are supporting, which is amazing. And your partner is a pretty innovative engineer. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of the contraptions that he has thrown together for fungi.
He's a brilliant, sweet soul. He's a mechanic, one of the few mechanics in Sucumbíos that doesn't work for the petrol company. And he was actually had a really fortunate, great opportunity to learn how to and to install solar panels in the indigenous communities of the Ecuadorian Amazon and tropical forests in Costa Rica. And so in that course, not only is he installing them, but he's working to do capacity buildings with creating local technicians in the communities so that they can understand how the solar panels work and how to maintain them. So now that he's returning to the land and learning mycology and cultivation, he's taken over the laboratory, really, and he's got solar panels hooking up. I mean, he's taken broken fans and broken washing machine motors and converted them to create positive pressure in our quote unquote in our sterile room, and he adapted our. We built a homemade vapor distiller to make essential oils, and to and he helped convert the vapor distiller into an ultra pasteurizer for mushroom substrates. So one day we can make vapor distillers, and that afternoon we can use it to pasteurize agricultural waste products for the mushroom cultivation.
Wow.
So yeah, so it's just like it's cool because since tools and resources aren't available here, like there's not Walmart, there's not there's not like hardware stores to get whatever you need or Amazon.com to, or anything to get delivered to your house. Like that's not possible. So like filter patches, And so I just really, really appreciate his point of view of looking at things because, you know, I've been studying mycology for almost 10 years and just reading and assisting courses and looking at books and researches, yada yada. But you know, he's observing, learning biology for the first time, and his way of his approach to the cultivation and the different techniques. I'm like, no, don't do that. Like that's not what you do. Everybody, we all do it this way. And then he's just like, but why?
Yeah.
And,
oh, totally.
And he'll just create his own little, you know, new mechanism technique. And that's really where the success in our laboratory has come from because it's, you know, it's just made things so much simpler. And with the resources that we have, instead of, you know, like agar is extremely expensive here. And that's also another reason why remediation research and keeping, a bank of different species has been really difficult, and it's just not something we decided to step away from that approach because we don't have the finances in order to continue doing certain methods and techniques. And so it's really been interesting having him join me in the laboratory and being able to work together and bring in different minds and point of views to think about our challenges.
I'm curious about what you use for filter patches.
Well, prior, we have had so many different designs. And prior, we'd been using polyfill for lids, and now we just use aluminum foil without any filter for, like, spawn jars. But I had my buddy Rascal came down and Ava from Michael Uprisal, and they had brought us a bunch of filter discs, which are reusable. So we've been using filter discs for our liquid culture. We've switched to liquid culture majorly. And so that's, for now, that's a good, dependable source. And but we have used filters made out of, like, if you go to a tailor's shop where they cut clothes, trim clothes, they have bags, trash bags of wasted cloth and tiny pieces. So we would sew those into balls, hundreds of sewn little balls. And we would have, like, PVC pipe cut in two inch width and 3 inch diameters, and use that sort of like as a gooseneck with the filter patch shoved into the top. Then we started making filters with micro pore tape. And we would just spend hours making bags and filters. And not too long ago, we got a really sweet donation from Unicorn Bags. Lou Su, the owner of Unicorn Bags, actually flew down, and I reached out to him, you know, just asking for a donation. And he flew down here pretty soon after to actually see the laboratory for himself and give us some tips. And that was a really neat connection, and just kind of, you know, a nice relationship built, a lot of trust built there, because it was like, you're willing to come down and take a risk and see with your own eyes and see what you can do to support and help. And that was cool. So now we're making our own bags and with filter patches from Unicorn Bags, and
awesome.
There we go. Yeah.
And can anyone come visit you? I know you said Rascal and Ava came and visited, and I saw Nance Clem came. Are you welcoming guests and volunteers?
We are not accepting volunteers. We don't necessarily have the capability to receive guests. It costs a lot of energy and time, and totally. There's just so much going on, and we've been working with volunteers for so many years, and now we're just kind of like on this hibernation space where we're just focusing on our own skills and practical skills and what we can find. Dog fight under my hammock.
No, I feel the same way. It's, you know, sometimes you look out, but a lot of the times, you know, we used to accept, you know, volunteers for a day. It's pretty easy. I guess where you are, it's a little more difficult. But once it's more than one day and they, you know, housing and food and all that stuff, it becomes more of a hassle than it is help. Unless you get some really amazing people, but most of the time people are not that hardworking and just want the experience and wanted to check it out just for kicks and giggles. And then by the time you spend all those hours like hosting them and, you know, it's a lot. So I feel you.
Yeah. But then there's sometimes people who have the confidence and desire to share their specific skill sets and think that can support our communities. And we're stoked to be able to create the spaces for workshops for the local communities. And so Rascal and Ava came down and they helped us out with cultivation and also taught some courses. Nancy Klim was an absolute gem and helped us develop course content for the Guardians of the Soil, which is a course that we're working on with the Union of Affected People Against Texaco. Danny Newman has visited us and taught us ID and microscopy. Daniel Reyes and Pablo Asensio spent time with us sharing cultivation techniques that from their cultures. And so there's a lot of people on our outreach team from internationally, from afar, that keep in touch. And sometimes, you know, they recommend or sometimes we'll accept people because they're a part of a network or they have a desire to share their specific skills, and we know that could be a benefit here. So there's still that opportunity, you know.
Mm-hmm. And what can people do from home if they want to help?
Well, I think sharing your experience is probably the best thing that anybody can do. Like building your skill sets and sharing your experience. I think one of the things that's been so helpful for me is the Facebook community. I have a Facebook. One of the few reasons I have a Facebook is because of the Facebook groups that I'm in. Whether it's for mushroom cultivation or fermentation recipes or soil method techniques, I get into really specific groups, and the people there, those communities are a blessing. People take mm-hmm. their time to support you and explain their methods and suggestions, and they give you their advice, not expecting anything in return. And I really, I'm really grateful for those online spaces because, you know, we're at this point in time where everybody needs to have access to information and do the work from home with what you have at home and locally and document and share those findings. Share your findings. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think is critical is that whether you have a business or you're a teacher or whatever your services may be, to always think about the marginalized communities that don't have the ability to pay for your courses or your products, and to be creative about reaching out to them or doing fundraising or specific donations to get their inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so, like, when we offer courses, I mean, we're in one of the poorest regions in Ecuador, right? So if we offer a paid course, like, it's a very selected audience that's going to come here. Our products, you know, it's not free for us to produce our products. So it's a selected audience that's going to be able to buy our products. But the most vulnerable communities here are the ones that are most exposed. They're the poorest farmers that are most exposed to the contamination. And so one of the things that we've been doing is, especially for international travelers who've come here or people who feel like they have the extra funding that often visit us in the farm, we have a deal on our products where you can buy two, get one. You can pay for two and you get one. And the other product is donated to one of the cancer patients that the Union of Affected People Against Texaco is supporting. Or it helps us provide different resources in Spanish, or make sure that that we can go to farther away communities to offer courses that aren't easily available. If you if you're looking to support, if you're feeling a calling to this medicine and movement, for every $13 donated, that provides 60 milliliters of mycomedicinal tinctures that we produce. And that's cheap. Mm-hmm. and so Right. Normally we provide tinctures through donations to the cancer patients, but right now with the quarantine, we can't get to the patients, and on those who were buying their products are no longer have an income and are in much tougher situations currently. So that's one of the possible ways to support us from afar. Or if you have other ideas about creative fundraising and are interested in supporting Amisatsu Restoration to offer courses or to be able to support people's transportation so that they can leave their communities or leave their farm to go to the Hope Fair, those are all ways that you can contribute. And so there's different ways to support from afar, whether that's sharing your experience or sharing your wealth too. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. That was informative. And I'm a little curious about different actions being taken against this criminal fiasco caused by Texaco. You know, it seems like the legal effort to get them to take responsibility didn't go anywhere. And then the whole micro-remediation thing was a little over-romanticized. What are people doing now to cope and hopefully clean this up?
Well, recently, nine girls under the age of 10 have sued Petro Amazonas, which is the state-owned oil company, for the gas flares, for putting them at risk, young girls and pregnant women at risk. So it was a specific strategy that these families took to sue the petrol company. And I was sitting in on that hearing, and it was so intense. The 6 different lawyers that the Ministry of Environment and the petrol companies had, they were just ruthless. They were just ruthless and saying that, referring to the Texaco case, that nobody was ever able to demonstrate that Texaco caused the petroleum contamination here. And it was so heartbreaking. But that verdict was postponed due to the quarantine. So hopefully some type of interesting news will come out of that. All of our work really has been dedicated to support the movement of URAMPT, the Union of Affected People, and La Clínica Ambiental. La Clínica Ambiental, environmental clinic, has offered free permaculture courses to affected farmers throughout the region for the past 5-7 years. And so Amisatsu is working with Clinica and with URAMPT, we in a local alliance. And right now we're working on this course called The Guardians of the Soil, Los Guardianes del Suelo. And this course is it's an addition to the permaculture course to start reflecting on what it is that we can do at the level of the household to protect ourselves, identifying different possible contamination sources, whether that's water, soil, food, air, and remediating to a point that we're able to, being able to identify these sources and being able to create solutions for them one by one at the best of our abilities. And the foundation of this course is to really strengthen, fortify the social cohesion between all of these impacted communities. And that's the most beautiful, it's just what motivates us and animates us. And so I guess to backtrack a little bit, La Clínica Ambiental and URAPT, in response to the Texaco case, created their own reparation committees. So there's a health reparation committee, there's an environmental reparation committee, and there's cultural reparation committee, and and a couple others in development. The Health Reparations Committee, they've been training health therapists from different communities throughout the region and training them in alternative therapies because of the elevated cancer rates and illnesses in and around petroleum extraction areas. They've been training these health therapists in alternative therapies like biomagnetism and nutrition and psychotherapies and tapping. And now those therapists are also starting to use our mycomedicinal tinctures, and that's why we donate the mycomedicinal tinctures to the therapists. And they're doing all these different treatments, visiting the cancer patients that don't have the ability to go all the way to keto, 8 hours to keto to the cancer hospitals. And so there's just a lack of recognition of the magnitude, the severity of the health situation here, as far as the state goes. So there's not local resources and local hospitals to support that these treatments. So the health therapists are amazing. Their work, you can find videos, documentaries about their work on YouTube. Really cool. What's it called? Mujeres remediando. I think that I'd have to follow the link. I'll send you the link later. But anyways, so the health committee is really inspiring. So now with the Guardians of the Soil, to bring it all back together, this is the first course to support the Environmental Reparations Committee and just start treating, you know, using healing the soil as a way to also heal trauma. Yeah.
That's great and amazing work that you're doing. From all that I've heard from all the years of talking with you, you know, negotiations with committees have been long and strenuous sometimes, and just to get that organization and can be very stressful at times, especially to get everyone on the same page. And you know, it's hard work, especially if you are dealing with these giants that, you know, bulldoze your projects in the middle of the night, or hire the best lawyers, or bribe the laboratories, or bribe the judges, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like an impossible battle that you're facing. And even though it can be so crystal clear to everyone in the court of law, you know, in their system, and you know, there's a lot of corruption that, you know, and it's things like this. It's you know, we gotta do what we gotta do, and people are still, you know, at the end of the day, if the case is lost or it's postponed, like, people still have cancer, you know, people still can't drive 8 hours to go to the cancer clinic, and life goes on, you know, and so we have to take these initiatives to make sure that people's needs are being met. As we're seeing with, like, coronavirus right now, it's like, you know, we have to adapt and we have to get grassroots and, you know, organize our communities and do these efforts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's, being in this quarantine reemphasizes the need for local autonomy, and having, you know, having food and medicines, whether it's on your land or whether it's in your local community, like, it's a necessity. And having that local social cohesion is a necessity. Yeah.
So moving the conversation from like a super serious note to maybe like a playful one, how is the mushroom foraging where you are? Do you find a ton of different biodiversity of mushrooms? Do you find cordyceps ever? What, do you have a favorite Amazonian fungi that you find?
Yeah. There's all types of wild, colorful, weird forming critters out there. We actually, when you talk about cordyceps, we have this one house here. We have a bunch of cabins on our property, and there's one that is always covered with dead ants. And I was just like, what is happening here? And when I started looking at the ants, I recognized that they were completely like myceliated. They had cordyceps growing out of them. And so it's been, I want to say almost a year now that this house, one house, is always colonized with dead ants. And I even, sometimes I'll go just to watch the ants crawling up it, and they'll just start walking in circles just without a destination. And I'm like, whoa.
I hope you're recording this. I want to see videos.
I need a better camera, but I have taken some videos. And even on our mushroom grow hut, like in the fruiting chamber, we'll get a lot of moths, cordyceps taken moths, just glued
in your fruiting chamber?
On the outside of the walls. They're just like screen walls. It's
just, wow.
So I feel like they're helping us keep insect predators out.
I'm dying to go back to Ecuador. I was there 2015. It was really like the year that I seriously, seriously got into mushrooms and fungi, and found so many different cordyceps, ophiocordyceps, just entomopathogenic fungi, and had this whole collection of them. And I lost it the day before I left. And I gave the box full to someone to look at all the different specimens, and then I asked him, like, you know, I was packing up my bag about to go to the airport, and I was like, where's the box, you know? And he was like, oh, I set it down over there. And, you know, it was like he said, she said, and, you know, I think someone found it and definitely threw it out, not knowing that was valuable, you know, a box of insects for someone. But But totally, like, crazy amount of biodiversity, and I feel like there's so many species that are new to science that can be discovered, and a lot of benefits as well for drug discovery, medicinal application, natural insecticides. I'm sure there's a lot of insect pests, and to find a fungi to naturally control it, or for enzyme production. You know, it's kind of interesting. Like, I follow this enzyme company, and they do work with a lot of big industries, and they use fungal enzymes in like soy production and corn production, and even like ethanol production. But the addition of these enzymes makes it a little more eco-friendly. You know, it's not a complete different option, but, you know, it's helping to, you know, help a little bit. So I think, you know, taking the most biodiverse place in the world, and really using those specimens as a prime example for, ecological preservation. You know, I, especially the work that Juliana is doing in Chile, you know, I think using as many of these species as conservation efforts, I don't think fungi will be the number one. I think it'll be like a jaguar or something cute or notable rather than like a weird looking fungi for conservation. But there's richness that we're losing every second. And work like you're doing, people like you are helping this planet. And so we're super grateful for the work that you're doing, and we're thankful that you can come on our show. And with that, we have one final question, and we ask this to all the guests on our show. And that question is, if mushrooms had the microphone and could tell the whole human race one thing, what would they say?
I think they would scream to tell us to behave as if the future of our species directly depended directly depends on the health of our ecosystem and the community relationships. I think if I've learned anything from fungi, it's that they don't work alone. And there's so many types of fungi with different roles and niches and talents. And within the wood wide web, the whole mycelial network under the ground, under the forest floor, they work with different tree species, different bacteria, and they actively contribute to the health of their environment, right? And so that they tell us to behave as if the future of our species directly depends on the health of our ecosystems. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the most important
message. Definitely. I hope the people at Chevron listen to this podcast and have a change of heart.
Not to point fingers or anything.
So maybe a pandemic is needed to help us hear their message.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks so much, y'all. Yeah, and I appreciate you inviting us to share our story here and sending y'all big hugs from the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, likewise. I hope we can cross paths sooner rather than later. So where can people find you and follow your work and support the Amisacho restoration?
You can follow us on Facebook at Amisacho, A-A-A. A-M-I-S-A-C-H-O. You can follow us on Instagram. You can follow us on our website, www.amisacho.com. If you're interested in contacting us, you can use one of those medias or email info@amisacho.com. If you're interested in supporting or donating tinctures to our community members, you can reach out to me and I can share with you information on how to do that, and we can work together afar.
Awesome.
And anything else that you find interesting or would like to hear more information about, we're here to collaborate. So thanks a lot for tuning in.
Yeah. Thank you, Lexi.
Much love, Lexi. Thanks for coming on.
Abrazos. Cuídense mucho. Ciao.
Ciao.
So that wraps up another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Much love, everyone. May the spores be with you.